Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today I want to talk a bit more about the partition of India in 1947, and I'm working from a book by Narendra Singh Savila, brilliantly researched piece of writing, really excellent kind of archival work that points at some very interesting truths, really, about Britain's motivations regarding the partition. And this is the kind of the aspect of this particular area that I think is really, really worth examining. This is the 70th anniversary this year, obviously, of the trauma of the partition. And there are a lot of new works on the subject, some really good oral histories, some really good documentary histories coming out there. But the Shadow of the Great Game by Narendra Singh Savila, it goes back a few years now, this title, but it's well worth a read. Now, to give you a little bit of context on the partition, I think what happens sometimes is when this area is being studied, the topic of independence and the question of partition get rolled into being one and the same thing, as if they are the same historical process, and in many ways they're not. Partition only really becomes a distinct possibility in the 3 or 4 years really in the before the run-up to independence. And the idea that that this presents to us is that there's nothing exactly inevitable about partition. In fact, there were a number of possible options being entertained for a kind of a Muslim self-rule within an Indian Commonwealth, and or other options as well. And so, division of the country was not a kind of an inevitability, and in many ways, it is an engineered process. On the day that Germany surrendered in the 5th of May 1945, Winston Churchill ordered an appraisal of the long-term policy required to safeguard the strategic interests of the British Empire in India and in the Indian Ocean. This was commissioned given to the post-hostilities planning staff of the War Cabinet. On the 19th of May, a top-secret document was given to Churchill. The central point of this document was that Britain must retain its military connection with India or the Indian subcontinent to keep the Soviet Union out of the region. The report gives four reasons for the strategic importance of India to Britain. Its value as a base from which forces located there could be suitably placed for deployment both within the Indian Ocean area and the Middle East and the Far East. A transit point for air and sea communications, a large reserve of manpower of good fighting quality from the northwest, of which British air power could threaten Soviet military installations. The speed with which all this would become irrelevant is very interesting. By the end of 1945, large numbers of Indian soldiers, now demobilised and still serving, flat refused to enforce Britain's rule in Asia any longer. The experience of putting Indian National Army men, the Indian National Army obviously being the anti-British, pro-Japanese army that had fought the British in and fought British Indian troops as well in Burma and on the borders of India. The experience of seeing them put on trial at the end of the Second World War, the trial ending in something of a farce, and the INA men basically being unconvictable in India, dealt a huge blow to British power and prestige. And once the chiefs of Imperial General Staff realised that they could no longer effectively command Indian military manpower, one of the last vast resources of British power in Asia dwindled away. And at that point, the writing was on the wall for the Raj. But in May 1945, Churchill didn't believe this. Lord Wavell, the viceroy from 1943 to early 1947, to be replaced by Mountbatten, realised the following things. He realised, as a result of this study and his own personal experience of India, that India was no longer of immense economic value to Britain. It wasn't going to be a great market for British goods any longer, but it would be a way of extending British power into Asia and the Middle East. The British were far more interested in the emergent value of the Middle East as a resource to control. The British would soon have to withdraw from India. Britain didn't have the political or military power to stay in India, and the rule of India would doubtless be passed over to the Congress Party and its leadership. They were unlikely to cooperate with the British. They were unlikely to become allies in security or intelligence or in foreign policy. But there was another player in town, the Muslim League Party, who wanted a partition of India, and they were far more cooperative with the British. The British looked upon them as being far more favourable. The Muslim League wanting a partition of India and the Congress not wanting it meant that it was possible, in the eyes of some British military planners, for the creation of a new state where the British could still maintain a foothold. The breach to be caused in Britain's capacity to defend the Middle East and the Indian Ocean could be plugged if, for example, the Muslim League were to succeed in separating India's strategic northwest from the rest of the country. This was entirely possible and a realisable goal, considering that Linlithgow, who was the viceroy at the start of the Second World War, had built strong ties with Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the leader of the Muslim League, during the Second World War. Wavell discussed this with Churchill in March 1945, and in his diary, Wavell notes that Churchill had already contemplated the possibility of dividing India. This discussion also chimed, this possibility in Churchill's mind also chimed with the things that Wavell had come to believe. And all of these calculations and plans were informed by the perceived threat of the Soviet Union. Auchinleck, who we've discussed in the last few podcasts when talking about the Desert War, believed that the British Indian Army, would stand firm. It would be led by British officers, of course, in his colonial view, and that British officers leading Indian troops would be a firm deterrent against the possibility of Soviet incursion into India or into Afghanistan or Persia. This was a view that was generally popular among the chiefs of staff, and there was a great many officers who had experienced fighting in Burma and in places like Kohima and Imphal, and had seen how British and Indian troops and how Sikh, Hindu and Muslim troops had worked together for the common goal of the defence of India, and thought that this would be a possibility into the future. But the reality, of course, was that priorities of a future independent India would not be set by the British. They would be set by a new Congress government, one led by Nehru, who had at least sympathies towards the Soviet Union, if not even the overtures of the possibility of some kind of alliance or understanding between the two powers. This again would take the Army of India out of its traditional imperial role of imperial, or in this case, Commonwealth defence. All of this made the possibility of a new state of Pakistan more enticing to the British government, and when Churchill was defeated in the 1945 general election and replaced by a Labour government, there was no particular change in these sorts of enthusiasms. It's a real mistake to think of the Labour government of 1945 as being the kind of socialist administration that would have been enthusiastic about decolonisation. Far from it. By 1947 and 1948, plans were being drawn up for the remainder of the empire, particularly Malaya, to develop them in ways in which had been last conceived of under the era of Joseph Chamberlain, that there would be a substantial investment in empire and hopefully a kind of development of new infrastructure and new industry in the remainder of the empire, which would eventually create wealth for the empire, and particularly for.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
For a cash drought post-war Britain. In Narendra Singh Sarila's book, in the Shadow of the Great Game, he writes, "By early 1947, the British chiefs of staff had become enthusiastic proponents of Pakistan that would cooperate with Britain in military matters. On the 12th of May 1947, General Leslie Hollis wrote to Prime Minister Clement Attlee, highlighting the views of the chiefs of staff who wanted to, in inverted commas, deal with Western India. First of all, from the strategic point of view, there are overwhelming arguments in favour of a Western Pakistan remaining in the Commonwealth, maintaining defence ties with Britain." He makes the following points to buttress his views. Firstly, we should obtain important strategic facilities such as the port of Karachi and air bases in northwest India and the support of Muslim manpower. Secondly, we should be able to ensure the continued independence and integrity of Afghanistan. That was a key concern about the integrity of Afghanistan, owing to the possibility of it becoming a Soviet satellite, as it later does. Point three, we should increase our prestige and improve our position throughout the Muslim world and demonstrate the assistance Pakistan would receive the advantages of links with the British Commonwealth. Our link with Pakistan might have a stabilising effect on India as a whole, since an attack by Hindustan, which I presume was the term that was going to be used to describe a future Indian state, on Pakistan would also involve Hindustan in a war not with Pakistan alone, but also with the British Commonwealth. The position on the frontier might become more settled, since relations between the tribes and Pakistan would be easier than they could be with a united India. So there were lots and lots of reasons, lots and lots of strategic reasons, why the British would want to create a separate Muslim state out of the Indian Empire, and for it to help serve Britain's wider strategic purposes. It's interesting when you look at the language about talking about the British Commonwealth. The post-war realities of the Cold War, of two new superpowers, and very little of anything kind of robust existing in between, had at this point not really become abundantly clear. The idea of a Commonwealth as a kind of a global polity, and a particularly kind of robust one, that would come to the defence, sort of like a minor United Nations, if you will, or a minor League of Nations, would come to each other's defence if threatened. That was quite a powerful and ultimately illusory idea in the minds of the British establishment, one which doesn't really manifest itself in anything other than the kind of like the grandiose club that it essentially becomes. General Hollis went on to say, "Quite apart from the positive arguments in favour of this course, we would draw your attention to the sorry results of refusing an application by Mr. Jinnah, which would, in effect, amount to ejecting a numerous and loyal people from the Commonwealth. We should probably have lost all chance of ever getting strategic facilities anywhere in India. We should have shattered our reputation in the rest of the Muslim world and could not look for the continued cooperation of Middle Eastern countries. From the military point of view, such results would be extremely bad." So Hollis is saying, really, well, India's kind of lost anyway. And so if we don't help for the establishment of a state of Pakistan, and we don't listen to what Muhammad Ali Jinnah has to say, then we will lose our reputation across the Muslim world. We will be in danger of losing any sort of influence in India and will make a huge mistake. Now, one of the great ironies was that the Muslim population in India, obviously, are not a homogenous block. They are scattered across Indian states, and there are states where there are Muslim majorities and states where there are minorities. In the states where there are Muslim majorities, life for Muslim people in the state was relatively stable, and the threat of ethnic violence relatively low. And therefore, the desire for partition, again, is relatively low. When people generally don't feel they're going to be murdered by their neighbours, they tend to be less inclined to do anything about it. The states where there was a low percentage of Muslim people, where they were in a minority, the desire for partition, for protection, is relatively high. And so the Muslim population in India was by no means unified behind the idea of partition. And it was often those in the best circumstances that wanted the least change, which I suppose would make sense. And the way in which British generals and mandarins speak about the Muslim peoples of the Middle East and the Muslim peoples of India, again, this smacks of this typical European kind of orientalism. You know, they're all the same. And we can, by helping the partition in India, we can gain a great deal of favour with people in Saudi Arabia, or in Jordan, or Syria, or Iraq, or wherever. Whether that was possible, whether the peoples of the Middle East were paying a great deal of attention to the partition, I don't know. But it seems quite a bold aspiration. But the other group that the British were hoping to appeal to was, of course, the United States of America. American diplomats in India were courted by British governors, and Americans in London and Brits in Washington spoke of the need to use Pakistan as part of the kind of cordon sanitaire around the Soviet Union. And later, when post-partition, post-independence, post-partition, Pakistan does indeed become a very useful American asset, one of the CENTO powers, or the Central Treaty Organization powers, along with Persia, Iraq, and a variety of other states such as Turkey, that managed to kind of prevent Soviet advance southwards. The central and Middle Eastern counterpart to NATO, if you will. The interests of the British are switched from India economically. India had previously been a reasonable source of Britain's cotton in the 19th century, though the southern states of America by the 1830s and 1840s were the world's biggest producer and continued to be so for the rest of the century. India also represented a large market for British goods. But really, in economic terms, after the Second World War, the centre of imperial interests shifts westwards from India to the Middle East. And it was there that the British really saw their interests lying. And they thought that there was every chance of Soviet penetration into the Middle East, and the possibility of the loss of the Suez Canal and the loss of Middle Eastern oil fields. One of the motivating reasons for the attack on the seizure of the Suez Canal and the attack on Egypt in 1956 was the fear that Colonel Nasser, the president of Egypt, was about to turn the canal over to the care of the Soviet Union. Whether or not in reality this would have happened is unclear, but NASA was indeed a rather eager Soviet client. As one old intelligence hand at the end of the Second World War put it, the strategic movements of the Allies in Iraq and Persia in the Second World War were made possible from the Indian base. The importance of the Gulf grows greater, not less, as the need for fuel expands. The world contracts and the shadows lengthen from the north, meaning the Soviet Union. Its stability can be assured only by the close accord between the states which surround this Muslim lake, and an accord underwritten by the great powers whose interests are engaged. Now, of course, the partition is caused by many things, and it's foolish of us to simply don our tinfoil hats and suggest that it is simply the machinations of men in smoke-filled rooms. But for our purposes, the men in these smoke-filled rooms, Churchill, Wavell, and people like them, have written down in their diaries and in official documentation and reports precisely what they intended. So we're not going into the realm of conspiracy theory here by any stretch of the imagination, but we must remember that the horrors of the partition are kind of a social history as well, and that the history kind of rises from below more often than it is manipulated from the top. So what we'll try to do as we go on through the podcast over the next year or two now is revisit the partition as often as we possibly can do and look at various different angles of this great and tragic phenomena, of which this is an important one, but only just an aspect of it. Anyway, so I'll finish there. Now, swing by the Facebook page if you can. I'm doing a lot of Facebook Live stuff there this week, particularly for students, and you can catch us there at any time. Some great conversations happening, some really interesting stuff, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.